In the news.
Howdy, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
Week two.
That's right.
Week two. All right, we wanted to just make a couple of announcements with respect to the logistics of the class before we get into the substance of the In the News segment. As you know, and if you don't know, you know now, the exam, first exam, will be next Monday. Correct, Professor McDaniel? Make sure we want to get it exactly right. So that's Monday, June 18th. So check with Canvas or your syllabus to get the specs on that. If you have any questions or comments, you can email Professor McDaniel or myself. I have office hours on Thursday. Professor McDaniel has his traditional office hours as well this week. So let's get that going. Oh, a small point also. Please email Professor McDaniel and I directly to our UT emails. Please don't use Canvas. It's just a little inefficient, and sometimes when we respond, it doesn't go directly to your email, and so there can be some misinformation if you use Canvas. So please email us directly. I would encourage you to email Professor McDaniel and myself and Philip and Jay, the TAs. So there's kind of a nice stream, and we can get, you know, if you put four people on the thread, the chances of us getting back to you very quickly are much higher. So anything else we want to mention on those sorts of topics?
No, that's really the key thing, is being aware of the exam, but also the emails.
Got to be aware of the exams. Yes. All right. So what do we got this week?
So what to start off with is talking about what was supposed to be a really big thing, but kind of ended for some people with a thud, and that is the cake case that the Supreme Court handled. This dealt with a baker in Colorado who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex ceremony. And the baker argued that as an artist, you know, that because of my religious beliefs and this is an artistic expression, that everything I do is an example of how I feel, that doing this violates my religious views. And the state of Colorado actually ruled in favor of the same-sex couple. It was challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the baker. However, and this is a 7-2 decision, in a 7-2 decision, they ruled in favor of the baker. However, many people have painted this decision as very narrow, where they did not say, yes, you have the right to refuse service to individuals because of religious beliefs, or no, you don't have the right to do this. They actually ruled in favor of the baker because of the way in which the Colorado board, which oversaw this, made their decision. They felt that they overly discounted the baker's religious beliefs. And so this is really more of an administrative issue. And so the way the court made their decision, it was more about the administration as opposed to the actual civil liberties, civil rights issue that we're hoping to have resolved. And so what this does is it does open up the door for future cases like this as we try to figure out how do we balance the rights of groups with the rights of individuals, and how are we able to allow individuals to live their lives as they see fit without interfering with the way other people feel they should live their lives as they see fit. And so again, this is really a conflict of rights and liberties, and how do we resolve this? The Supreme Court really did not resolve that. What they really dealt with was an administrative issue. And so this has not been resolved. And many people have argued this is going to be a political issue for the 2018 midterms, as we see this as a way of fighting over religious liberty versus the rights of other individuals.
You know, look, this is a fascinating case. Two small points and I'll get out. The one small point I would begin with is that, you know, for our purposes, for purposes of an intro to American government class, this is a really interesting case because on the one hand, you have a baker who says, you know, I have to have the right, you know, to, because of my religious beliefs, I do not wish to contribute to this same-sex union. It's my business, you know, it's not a public business. So, you know, forcing me to provide a service is tantamount to infringing upon my religious freedoms. On the other hand, you have a same-sex couple who says, look, we just, you know, this is a person who's selling things and has refused to sell them to me. I mean, how is this different than civil rights cases involving, you know, African-Americans and discrimination in the 1950s or 60s? So when Professor McDaniel talks about the resolution of these conflicts, that's what he's talking about. What the court said in the case was that the Colorado Board had essentially not even really considered religion. In fact, the Colorado Board, if you go read their take on the case, was pretty incendiary. I mean, essentially what they said was religion, you know, religion's been used to justify genocide and racism for centuries, and slavery, religion doesn't really, and that is what really formed the basis of the majority's opinion. The majority on the court, Supreme Court said, the state needs to clean up its business here. The state did not, in fact, set these rights up as competing rights and then adjudicate. They just didn't even count the religious. So for those of you out there who are concerned about, oh, my gosh, does this mean, you know, you can have discrimination justified by religion? I wouldn't go there. I think, as Professor McDaniel suggested, that decision is coming. And my guess is that, that will probably be consistent with the civil rights decisions we've seen in the past, which is, look, if you set up a shop, you know, you can't deny service to people on the basis of race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. That's a guess on my part. The court did not rule that here. They put off the ruling. Second point, and this is a small technical point, since we're doing a class in government, we want to talk about the courts. It was interesting that it was a 7-2 decision, as Professor McDaniel said. So the conservatives sided with, you know, the right of the individual, or basically slapped down the state's ruling, saying you have to sell the cake. But the two liberals, Kagan, Elena Kagan, and Stephen Breyer, sided with the majority. And I think the reason they did that was to get their opinions into the majority opinion. In other words, I think they were setting the table for the decision that's coming in the future about these larger issues of religious liberty versus, you know, civil rights and rights of people to be served, right? And if they hadn't done that, if they'd have said, well, you know, that's a technical issue, but we think the bigger issue is this, and we're going to be with the minority. The minority, by the way, in this case, the two on the other side were Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They wouldn't have gotten that into the majority opinion. So in this sense, I think it was a strategic move on the part of the two liberals to set the table for the subsequent decision. So yeah, that's my take. Those are the two points I wanted to make with respect to that. We got some other stuff going on, though, obviously, right?
Oh, yes.
What do you got next in our hopper?
So there is the G7 summit, and some of you may be asking, what's the G7?
What's the G7, Professor McGinnis?
So it's not a new rap group, as I thought. I was like, oh, something to counter the Wu-Tang Clan. No, actually, the G7 is an annual meeting amongst really the economic heavy hitters in internationally. So you have Canada, France, Great Britain, Germany, or the United Kingdom, not Great Britain, Germany, Italy, Japan, European Union, along with the U.S. As part of this. Now, at one point in time, Russia was part of this, but it was removed in 2014 because of its annexation of Crimea, which is in the Ukraine. And so because of Russia's kind of aggression, acts of aggression, it was removed from the summit. Now, the summit is mainly there to talk about really economic issues, so global economic issues, national security issues, but then also things dealing with the environment and things of that nature. Now, one of the things about this summit that stood out was that, as you'll see from the picture that's kind of become viral.
Ooh, show the picture.
Is that, you know, it's been treated as President Trump versus everyone else.
Why would you get that impression from this picture?
I don't know. but this picture, and so, I mean, again, many of the things that they agreed upon, or that they would normally agree upon, President Trump said, no, I don't agree upon this. And this is part of President Trump's trend of really pulling out of a number of international agreements, such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and there's also the fate of NAFTA, which is, well, I guess, what, 25 years old now,
yeah,
right?
The North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico.
And so, I mean, it's old enough to rent a car now, but President Trump is basically argued that many of these deals have put the U.S. at an economic disadvantage. And again, if you think of his campaign rhetoric, it really stressed this idea of making the U.S. a more powerful in the international market, and the idea that the U.S. was getting the short end of a variety of these economic bargains. And so this is part of his plan in many ways to move unilaterally, not work with other nations, but for the nation really to work out, do what's best for its interest. And in his eyes, this will improve the U.S. economy and allow the U.S. to have a stronger foothold within the international or global perspective.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back, if we can get that picture up again. My observations are not terribly political science-y, they're more sort of public relations. If I were Trump's advisors, political advisors, I love this picture. This picture went out, it was actually leaked by the Germans. It was from a secret meeting, or at least a non-public meeting. And it was meant to kind of demonstrate to the world that, Trump had sort of isolated himself and was, at odds with these other countries, wasn't getting with the program, was being obdurate. But I got to tell you, you look at Angela Merkel there, who has her hands on the desk. She's the chancellor, president of Germany. And then the prime minister of Japan is sitting there with his arms folded, kind of looking off. I got to say, Trump did very well in the election by talking about reasserting American authority. America, we're going to be so tired of winning. We're going to be sick of winning. If I'm Trump's supporters, I'm looking at that picture and, forgive my lapse into history right now, but I've got the Germans and the Japanese who are unhappy with America, sort of asserting its independence. I'm not so sure this is a picture that damages Trump amongst his supporters. And again, I'm not talking about the coherence of the policy or whether Trump is right to want to renegotiate these deals. I'm just talking about the optics of it. So it's funny. I think it was a picture designed to leak, to hurt Trump and to isolate him. I'm not so sure Trump would be dissatisfied with this picture. So you all have it, and you can kind of draw your own conclusions. My guess is, the lens through which you view that picture depends upon your attitudes towards Trump in the first place. If you don't like him, that picture just shows why, nobody likes him and reinforces your view. And if you like him, you look at that picture and you're like, yeah, that's exactly why we like him. So, and that we're getting a lot of that in American politics lately.
Yeah, one of the things that's important to know, you're seeing this not only within American politics, but also in other nations, is this growing populism. And people talk about populism a lot, but the way to understand populism is really this rhetoric in which a politician argues that that there's some type of corruption amongst the elite and there's some level of nobility amongst the masses. And it kind of pits the masses versus a subsection of the elite who they believe are evil and corrupt. And so you see this coming out of President Trump's rhetoric, but you also see it coming out of Bernie Sanders' rhetoric as well. And so it's very important to say that when people talk about populism in many ways say that there's these people who are pure, good of heart, who are being led astray by this section of the elite, and we need to control these groups. And so much of the rhetoric coming out of President Trump and also coming out of Bernie Sanders was this idea that Americans, the real Americans, and again, we can debate about who the real Americans are getting the short shrift or being cheated by these elites, and that I am going to give power back to you. And so you see this going on. So it's not just the coastal elites that have been attacked, but also this idea of other nations. With the growth of globalization, these other nations are dictating what the U.S. does. And because of that, that has undermined the nation's mission. And so this is really moving back to not necessarily isolationism per se, but a very focus on unilateral, that we don't care what you think, we're going to do things our way. You do not tell us what to do.
Okay. We want to speak now, the modules that you're going to see, we're transitioning now, obviously, as you're getting through the first set of modules, lectures that focus on the Constitution and federalism and civil rights and civil liberties. We'll be moving into institutions and public opinion and voting. And I did want to take advantage of the elections that occurred on June 5th, a week ago, that are going to be very important setting the table for the 2018 midterm elections. And so last week we had primaries in California, in Alabama, Iowa, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota. A whole hodgepodge of different states. I'm not going to go over the results of those primaries, except to say there were some, if you're interested in reading the tea leaves, that is trying to ascertain what's going to happen in the fall based on what happens in the primaries, you can kind of have a field day with some of the primary results. In California, they have this bizarre primary system where everybody is listed on the same ballot. So there's not a Republican ballot and a Democratic ballot like, there, for instance, there is in Texas. Everybody's listed on the same ballot, and it's not the top Republican, the top Democrat that advance. It's the top two vote-getters. It's called a jungle primary. And one of the things you can do is take a look at the total votes for the Republican in a district or across a state and the total votes for Democratic candidates and add them up and say, like, oh, well, the Democrats look like there's more enthusiasm on their side, or vice versa. You know, you've seen articles on both sides talking about how to read the June 5th primaries. On the whole, I think, you know, it doesn't do anything to dissuade people from thinking that the Democrats are going to have a good year in 2018, for reasons we'll talk about in just a sec. So I just want to say a couple of things. So all that was on June 5th, but it's pursuant to the election that's coming up this November. And I just want to say a couple things. So these are midterm elections. They're for Congress. Every 2 years, all 435 members of the House are up for election, right? So the entire House will be up for election. And then one-third of the Senate. As you all know from reading your Constitution, there's staggered terms for the Senate. So out of the 100 members, 33 or 34 will be up in any given year. There's a couple more than 33 this time around. I think there's 35 elections because there'll be a special election in Minnesota. Al Franken's replacement in Minnesota will be up for sort of confirmatory election. There is another special election in Mississippi. There may be, depending upon John McCain's health, a special election in Arizona. You know, good luck to John McCain. Hope he makes it. But if he doesn't, there could be another election there. So there'll be a relatively high number of Senate elections. But so what do we think about these? Well, let me pop up just to kind of give you a sense of this. The New York Times has a nice map on this. So if you guys take a look at this, to reclaim the House, the Democrats need to flip 24 Republican seats. GOP stands for Grand Old Party. It's a nickname for the Republicans. And they say 25 of those seats are in Clinton territory. So what the Times article is saying is that the Democrats need to pick up 24 seats. There are 25 seats out there currently held by Republicans, but that voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So these are the obvious targets, right? And they have a nice graphic here. Right? Up at the top, you see ratings for each of the House races from solid Democrat. They got 182 of 435 seats are solid Democrat to solid Republican, 172 solid Republican seats. But I want you guys to concentrate on these in the middle. So 10 lean Democrat, 22 toss-ups, and 16 lean Republicans, right? And you see down here, they've got those graphically arrayed by the presidential vote margin in each district. So you take a look at those toss-ups, and those are seats that the Democrats are going to need to pick up a disproportionate amount of, and they've got them arrayed by how they went in the last presidential election. So that'll give you a sense. I think by and large, the consensus amongst the smart people, which certainly extends beyond our set here today, is that the Democrats will probably be able to pick up the 24 seats they need. But I think there's a high degree of variability there. So you remember before 2016, people thought that Hillary would probably win the election, but there was a high degree of uncertainty about that. I would put our current situation kind of in that same category. If you put a gun to my head and said pick, I'd say the Democrats would probably pick up the seats and retake the House, but high degree of variability there. All right. Now, if you want a visual orientation here, there's this nice website, 270 to Win. And let's see, you can stick with starting vote. Let me go up here, interactive house map. Let's see, so let's go with the current house. See if we can get that going here. Oh, we seem to have a little bit of trouble. Let's see if I can get that. Nope. Okay, so I can't get that. Let me see if I can go to the Senate. Let's move from the House over to the Senate. If the Democrats are kind of, you know, look like they've got a decent chance to take over the House, what about the Senate? And this map here shows the blue, if it's grayed out, it means there's no Senate election in this cycle. Okay, so, you know, you see Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, no Senate elections there. The colored states have an election. The blue states are where there is a Democrat seeking to be reelected. So, for instance, California has Dianne Feinstein, so that's blue. The red are states where there are Republican senators seeking reelection. So, you notice Texas is red, that's the Ted Cruz seat. And the tan states mean there's an election, but it is considered a toss-up right now. So, for instance, you'll see Nevada. That's a Republican seat, but right now the incumbent Republican senator is in a very tough battle. In Arizona, there's a retired, Jeff Flake, retired the Republican senator. So that seat is considered a toss-up. Okay, now, so there's a lot of toss-up seats here, but what I would emphasize, and this is why the Democrats are in not the best shape with respect to the Senate, is you notice how many blue states are there? There are tons of Democrats who are seeking re-election, and most of the tan states are actually seats that are held by Democrats, where the Democrats are seeking to hold, but they're considered toss-ups. Now, so if you start from the west to the east, you see Nevada and Arizona. Those are toss-up states. Those are actually Republican seats. So those are chances for the Democrats to pick up seats. The Democrats need to pick up two seats in order to flip the Senate, right? So you'd say, like, well, Shaw, Nevada and Arizona, those are good chances, right? Yeah, except Montana, North Dakota, Wisconsin, Indiana, Missouri, Tennessee, Florida, Ohio, West Virginia, those are all Democratic seats, right? All of them are Democratic seats, right? And Democratic seats where the Democrats are considered odds on, you know, they're going to have a very tough time defending those seats. In other words, this time around, the Democrats are defending many more seats than the Republicans. So even if they pick up a couple, they could lose because there's so many targets of opportunity here. I think I misspoke. Tennessee is a Republican seat, by the way. So Tennessee is a chance for the Democrats to pick up. So Tennessee, Nevada, and Arizona are chances where the Democrats can pick up, but they have to successfully defend all those other seats in order to have a shot at retaking the Senate. Okay, so that map, by the way, so this is from the website 270 to Win. You can kind of do your own maps. It'll give you the races, and you can fill them in and kind of monkey around with it. You can also do that for presidential races. So it's kind of a cool site for those of you who are, you know, kind of geeky and want to see how. I love maps. Hopefully you guys like maps. And you can kind of monkey around with those. So, all right, that's more than you wanted to know, but it's an election year. We just had these primaries, and Professor McDaniel and I want to give you a little bit of a primer on what to expect moving forward. So, you know, in the House, Democrats, you know, the out party tends to pick up in the first year after a presidential election, and they don't need that much. On average, a 20-seat pickup is about what you would expect. So we're right in that kind of sweet spot for the Democrats, you know, so it looks okay. In the Senate, it's just a really tough map. This is the class that was elected in 2012, Obama's reelect year. And so you could argue there are a lot of seats that the Democrats currently hold, but they're not really Democratic states. So this is places like Montana, North Dakota, Missouri, states like that. One might expect, without President Obama at the top of the ticket, that the Republicans would have an advantage in those states. Okay, so that's all I got. Any insight here?
I mean, the primary is also important because they give an idea of the direction that the party is trying to go. And so we've seen that in many of the primaries that, at least for the Republican primaries, that if the candidate does not have President Trump's blessing, there's been some pushback against them. But also with the Democratic Party, one of the problems that they have is there's a lot of attempts like, okay, we can gain seats, but is there actually some level of cohesion amongst the group? So are they a party with actual plans, things of that nature, or are they just the anti-Trump party?
Right.
So just as the Republican Party was accused of being the anti-Obama party, do the Democrats actually have a clear plan? And again, there's an internal war there that even if they do get control of the House, will they be able to work cohesively? And so really the easy part is getting control. The hard part is actually getting things through. And that is really the next step. And the primaries kind of give us an idea of who's being put forward and the direction the party will head.
Yeah, and there's some trickiness to this, too. A lot of our attention has been focused on the Republicans because, you know, they control the White House, the both houses of Congress. And, you know, I had a friend actually just emailed me and said, you know, what does the Republican Party even stand for anymore? And I haven't figured out exactly what my response is going to be. But one of the things I will put in my response is, I think this is a problem for both parties. It's not clear to me, as Professor McDaniel suggested, the Democrats are anti-Trump, but, you know, within the Democratic Party, for instance, is the party going to move more towards a strong progressive agenda, you know, in the service of a lot of groups that have particular social identities? Is it going to be the, you know, the party that's serving, you know, African Americans and Latinos and Asians and LGBTQ, you know, communities? Or is it a party that, you know, is going to kind of return to its New Deal, Great Society roots, where it's working to try to benefit people along class lines and working class Americans of all stripes? And then there is a tension there about, you know, is the role of identity politics and this sort of new generation of voters versus traditional blue-collar, you know, Democratic appeals. And, you know, this is what Trump is doing, by the way. Trump is working really hard to remove the notion that the Democratic Party is the party of the white working class and workers generally. And this is something that is clearly happening. It's not even beneath the radar screen. I just think it's not getting as much attention as you might think. Last week, Trump pardoned a couple of prominent African-American, one historical figure, Jack Johnson, the other more contemporary figure who'd been in prison for years and years for, you know, for a, you know, kind of minor drug claim. This stuff is, Trump is pointedly working to kind of undermine the Democratic Party's hold on these traditional Democratic, you know, communities. And it's interesting, if nothing else. One other thing, as long as we're talking about elections, we'll close this out. Another important Supreme Court decision, I think, Professor McDaniel, you wanted to mention the Ohio case?
Yes. So the Supreme Court ruled yesterday in support of the state of Ohio for its voter, for purging of voters on its rolls. And so there was a federal law passed that said if you did not vote in two consecutive federal elections and did not reply to a postcard sent to your household, that you would be purged from the voting rolls. And so there was an individual in Ohio who had lived in his residence for 16 years, but because he did not vote in consecutive federal elections and did not reply to the postcard, when he went to vote, he was no longer registered. And so he was suing, saying that the way in which the state took purged him was arbitrary. The Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision ruled in support of the state, saying that, you know, that you may think this is arbitrary, but this is the law. And so if you want Congress to change the law, then Congress will have to do this. And this has really become this really the new front line of fights over voter registration. So whether it be voter ID, purging of voter roll, voter rolls, things of that nature, there seems to be this oncoming battle or ongoing battle regarding what are we going to do in terms of protecting the right to vote. And so there are these concerns that the right to vote is under attack, and the Supreme Court in many ways has buffeted those who believe, no, we're trying to root out voter fraud, things of that nature, and has raised concerns for those who believe that that voters' voting rights are under attack.
This was a really interesting case. You know, this individual in Ohio had voted in 2004, had voted again in 2008, but had decided in 2012 that he didn't like any of the candidates, and so had not voted in the federal election. Now, Ohio law says that if you miss a federal election, they send you a postcard because they're concerned that so many people move that there's a bunch of people registered at residences that they're not actually at, right? So this is part of the Ohio procedure. And they send you a postcard, and they say, like, you need to respond to the postcard and tell us whether you're still living here. And if you don't respond to the postcard, you can be purged from the voter rolls. And I think it's if you don't respond and then you don't vote in the next election or something like that. I think that's the technical law. So Ohio's defense was that, look, you know, we're allowed to do this as a state. We have the right under federal law to establish, you know, who's a registered voter and who's not. And we have this procedure. And the individual, you know, involved in the case said, this is a ridiculous procedure and violates my right to vote. I did not move. And what to me, what was interesting is Professor McDaniel alluded to, this is obviously part and parcel of this conflict between really Republicans and Democrats have partisan views on this, although it really shouldn't be. Because I think Republicans think that there's all this army of people out there who are not really registered, but you know, Democrats sneak onto the rolls and then vote, and they all vote for Democrats. And the Democrats are concerned the Republicans are trying to disenfranchise everybody who's not a, you know, a white upper class Republican looking individual. So there's a bit of paranoia, not saying it's not justified, but a bit of paranoia on both sides, with Democrats talking about suppression of the vote and Republicans talking about voter fraud. Okay. But what Alito did, Justice Alito, in writing the majority opinion here, had a really interesting point. Alito said, look, you know, this is a federal law that allows the states to do this. And the claim was, as Professor McDaniel correctly said, the claim was the law was arbitrary. And what the court ruled here, and this was 5-4, I think, right, Professor McDaniel? 5-4. So this really was the conservatives voting one way and the liberals voting the other. What Alito said, writing for the majority, was that Ohio had the right to do this. They had the right to establish this procedure, and the procedure was not, in fact, arbitrary. So they didn't really touch on, or they tried not to touch on, these issues about voter suppression and this sort of thing. Now, the minority writing opinion said, you know, what are you talking about? This is clearly at the heart of this issue, right? So they said, look, the majority can say what they want, but this is really about these voting rights issues. The majority said, no, it's actually about Ohio's right to have an established procedure by which you do this. So the opinions are kind of interesting. I went and looked at the opinion, and in the minority opinion, they talked about how, well, we know from social science, that's where we come in, that people don't tend to respond to these postcards, and the response rate is, so you're knocking a bunch of people off the voter files simply because people don't respond to these inquiries, and which is an interesting point. But Justice Alito, in writing for the majority, said, look, these are studies that aren't actually relevant to the case at hand, and besides, the minority has got this sort of odd, you know, kind of selective use of empirical evidence that we're not all that interested in here because it's not central to the case. The case is whether Ohio had a systematic procedure for doing what they are entitled by federal law to do. So it's really interesting. You know, Professor McDaniel, I love this stuff, and, you know, we're probably more enthusiastic about it than you are, but we want to kind of open your eyes to this sort of thing because there's all these interesting issues in here, right? You know, the rights of minorities, partisan politics, the politics of the court, and the Ohio case had it all. So, smallish decision compared to maybe the attention that goes to the cake case, but an important decision for American politics.
Very much so. And I mean, now there, the key thing about this is really about registration. And there are a few states, such as Minnesota, which have same-day registration. So in these states, it's not really a problem. And they actually do have higher voter turnout rates. And so there's really been this push for why don't all states just have same-day registration? If Minnesota can do it, other states can pull it off. And so you don't run into these problems. You don't have to worry about this fear of voter suppression. However, states, for a variety of reasons, set forth their registration guidelines. And be truthful, unless they violate federal law, they are allowed to do these things.
Yeah. We're also talking, Professor McDaniel and I have talked about this offline, about online registration, which I think is coming. Online registration is almost certainly going to be happening. And in fact, there's court cases right now that argue that if you provide online access to a driver's license through the DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles, or DPS in the case of Texas, that you have to provide voter registration online, because that's part of the Motor Voter Act that Congress passed back in the 1990s, that you can register at the DMV when you go to get your license. Well, if you can get your license online, then the state has an obligation to provide online voter registration service. So that's another case that is going to be important and impactful in the near future. So what else we got? We got a couple of things. Sorry to tax your patience, but maybe summer, but we got a lot of stuff going on here.
Yeah, I mean, this is when the Supreme Court's decisions really start rolling out. And there are a couple decisions that were made that came out early on. One decision I want to focus on really deals with collective bargaining amongst employees, and really with class action suits on the part of employees towards employers.
And we have to take this because I got nothing on this.
Yeah, we have a video.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Epic Systems, the Wisconsin-based healthcare software company, saw a victory this week after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in their favor. The 5-4 ruling says that employees cannot join together in legal action for issues that happen at work. This joining together, sometimes referred to as collective or class action, is common when people have similar, smaller claims. They come together and pool their resources to make their case. In 2014, Epic Systems established a non-disclosure agreement, requiring employees to waive their right to collective legal action. Employees also had to sign on to an arbitration agreement, meaning that disputes had to be settled out of court. When cases are settled through arbitration, they are legally honored under the Federal Arbitration Act. Arbitration can be seen as a quicker and cheaper alternative to settling a disagreement. But unlike cases brought to court, information from arbitration proceedings is usually confidential and not available to the public. The agreement Epic Systems had its employees sign onto said that problems with the employer must be settled through arbitration and on an individual basis. Agreeing to both of these was required in order for employees to keep their jobs. The four judges who ruled against Epic Systems argued that the law under the National Labor Relations Act is broadly meant to protect workers from the power of their employers. They contend that employees have the right to engage in concerted activities for the purpose of mutual aid and protection. The five judges that ruled in favor of Epic Systems argue that those concerted activities refer to collective bargaining, not class action lawsuits, and that changes to the law must be made by Congress, not by the court. Arbitration agreements are becoming increasingly common. A recent report from the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute estimates 60 million employees are subject to mandatory arbitration procedures.
For these and other fast facts, visit WPT.org.
So this case is very interesting because when we think about the Me Too movement and specifically concerns about wage and the gender gap in pay wage, there are concerns that women now, if they want to take up these types of cases, have to take them up individually. And there is a concern that in arbitration, because you are on your own, you may not have as many resources, that it's you versus the employer, and the employer has more power. And so this is seen as kind of undercutting attempts for employees to deal with systematic problems. And so they're dealing with systematic problems on an individual basis. And also it means a lot of action. Instead of something being done that affects the entire company, it helps all of the employees, it's really employee by employee in doing this. And so this is seen as a roadblock for dealing with a variety of problems that employees may have with their employer, whether it be the gender pay gap, whether it be some other type of issue, that this in many ways makes their attempts to improve the workforce at the individual level as opposed to a company-wide.
Ooh, good stuff. Yeah. We're talking about populism, we're talking about questions of equality, and one of the themes that we wanted to draw your attention to as we're talking about civil liberties and civil rights is, and as we talk about some of these court cases, is this notion of sort of groups and groups receiving protections under the Constitution or not receiving protections under the Constitution. We think of the Constitution as protecting individuals, as individual citizens who have a freedom of speech, right to assemble, freedom of religion. But the history of the United States has shown that the Constitution has, in broad parts, been applied to groups as well as individuals. And that's at the core of some of these cases involving arbitration rights and moving to things like campaign finance and the Citizens United decision, where groups were found to have the same free speech protections as individuals. It's just sort of fascinating. We think of the Constitution as being very much designed to protect the rights of individuals, but it's been viewed more expansively, and not just recently, throughout American history. So I think we got one more topic you wanted to hit before we get out of here for the day.
Yeah, so the last thing I want to talk about is really bring this back to Texas and something we're seeing happen with Texas policy. In particular, I think many of you are aware of the fact that there's a bit of a crisis regarding the testing of rape kits. So it's been recorded, I think it's estimated there are several hundred thousand untested rape kits. And Texas has a problem with a large number of untested rape kits. And there's actually been something put forward to try to help ease that. Particularly the reason these rape kits have not been tested is because of expense. And there's been some action put forward to help ease that expense or help the state pay for this. And so we have a video highlighting how the state is trying to address this problem.
In crime labs across Texas, thousands of rape kits sit untested, some for years.
For example, in Austin, we heard a story that these kits have been sitting there so long that they're growing mold on them. That is absolutely not acceptable.
Lawmakers trying to catch up on testing those kits have put in place ways for you to help, allowing people getting or renewing driver's license or state ID to contribute. That started January 8th.
And without any advertisement at all, we've already received 8,900 donations, totaling about $25,000.
When you register or renew your vehicle, donations can also be made to the Evidence Testing Grant Program.
With 24 million registered vehicles, I'm pleased to say that we have the opportunity to change that.
Rape kits sitting untested is not new in Texas.
And to find out that my kit sat on the shelf for over 20-something years was disheartening.
Lavinia Masters, raped at 13 by an intruder, who was eventually caught after her rape kit sat 21 years before being tested.
I want to make sure we get these kits off the shelf. People need their lives back. We are not just trinkets that's sitting there collecting dust.
State law now requires new rape cases to be submitted for testing in 30 days. This past session, lawmakers approved $4.2 million to cover costs, which runs between $300 and $2,000 depending on the amount of DNA available. Neave hoping the crowd getting a license and registering vehicles will bring in at least $1 million more each year.
And so we're hopeful that, you know, as our community is watching this, that if you can take a moment to contribute a dollar or any amount to help us bring justice to survivors of sexual assault.
So the crowdfunding needed because the legislature has not fully funded the payments for these rape kits to be tested. Coming February 1st, there's going to be a GoFundMe page through Deeds Not Words, another way where people can give.
So this, I guess, really crowdsourced funding of for the state government to test rape kits, so far has raised about $250,000. And so it has been able to raise a significant amount of money. The problem is, even with that, there's still a huge backlog. And so it would be millions upon millions of dollars that would need to be spent in order to test all of these rape kits. And again, well, this is a problem in Texas, this is a problem nationwide, where the cost for testing these rape kits is so high that it's basically some, many states have just not done anything because they can't afford to test all of these kits.
You know, I think what's kind of fascinating is the notion that you have something that is, you know, the responsibility of the government, that the government, and I don't know that this is a matter where Texas legislature has said, we don't think they ought to be funded. I think it's a matter of it's not a high priority for them. Yes. And, you know, we may find that regrettable and unseemly, but they do make choices all the time. And what's kind of fascinating to me is the notion that there would be an independent mechanism by which sort of a, I guess it's public, but, you know, kind of extra legislative mechanism for funding something that people think is consequential or important. I mean, I wonder at some point if we're going to get, you know, a tax form that says, you know, well, here's your tax bill and here are a number of checkoffs if you want to give $5. You know, I get this in professional memberships all the time, right? Checkoff box here, $5 for this, $10 to that. This isn't a crazy idea in some sense. And we do have this for your federal income tax. There's a little box that says, do you want to contribute to the public fund for presidential election campaigns, which, you know, actually candidates haven't used the public funding mechanism in a while, but does exist. So it already does exist at the federal tax level. Texas, of course, does not have a state income tax, but states that do have income taxes, I wonder if this is becoming more prominent as we deal with finite budgets and all sorts of, you know, important things that may be important, but nevertheless don't rise maybe to the level where they're going to commit on funding as opposed to education or, you know, criminal justice, some of these other things. So it's a fascinating report. Well, thank you all for joining with us this week. You know, I think that's good. We got anything else we wanted to draw to people's attention?
No, that's it. Thank you all so much and have a good rest of your week.
Yeah, everything's going pretty well. You all are doing a good job on your assignments. And so good luck on your exam and we'll see you next week.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.